Hi, I'm Margie, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their seven Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. I can't quite believe who my guests are today. I was over the moon when Dave and Si said that they would come on and share their desert island dishes with me. And my goodness, they did not disappoint. Two of the nicest men I've met, and so many delicious goodies in this one. And as always, when you're recording something, we turned out to be next to what I think was a bottle bank. So apologies if you can hear the bottles in the background. My guests today are the Hairy Bikers, whose real names are Dave Myers and Simon King. Dave previously worked as a makeup artist for the BBC, where he specialised in prosthetics. Si worked for many years as an assistant director and locations manager for film and television, including for the Harry Potter films. The pair met on the set of a TV drama 23 years ago and discovered that they shared a love of riding motorcycles, cooking and eating. Since then, their popularity has soared. They've gone on to have countless TV shows, and they've written more than 20 successful cookbooks, which is pretty impressive. So, very warm welcome to Dave and Si, aka the Hairy Bikers, aka the Hairy Dieters. You've had a name change.
We have. We've been Hairy Bakers in the past as well.
Yeah, we have. We just keep changing a word.
Yeah, well, you better not cut your hair, otherwise.
That would be a terrible thing.
Mine's on its way out, I think.
I feel a little bit ignorant because I didn't know the backstory of how you guys met. It was way back in 1995 on the set of a TV drama.
92.
Oh, 92. Yeah. Apologies.
Yeah. The gambling man, Catherine Cookson with Robson Green.
Yeah, and you both had very different careers. Like, weren't you working in prosthetics?
We did. Dave was working in prosthetics and I was an assistant director.
Yeah.
And we worked very closely together because that was the nature of our roles. And it was quite a big deal that particular film because Robson was just on the screen.
He was a
big star. And I mean, with the Cooksons, we worked with some massive names.
They were brilliant dramas, and it was Si had done a couple before, and I was the new boy. So I had my interview for the job as head of makeup and prosthetics. Yeah. And it was one of those things where if you got the job, you got sent downstairs to meet the rest of the crew who were in the pub.
Okay.
The Egypt Cottage next door to Tyne Tees. If you didn't get the job, you'd be sent to the car park and home.
Oh, no.
Well, I got the job, so I went down to the Egypt Cottage, and I always remember you were there playing pool.
Yeah.
And like the rest of the crew were there with their sandwich and spritzers. And he howled across to the landlord, "What's the curry today?"
"What's the curry today, Julian?" Because that was the landlord at the time.
Yeah.
That was the beginning of a firm friendship.
Yeah, and I just said, "I like what he's having." Then we got the work done very quickly that afternoon. Mm. I had an idea, like a woman with a wig was an hour and a quarter. A woman without a wig was three quarters of an hour. A fellow normally was a quarter of an hour. A fellow with whiskers to stick on was half an hour. So basically we had a rough schedule on...
I love it. And you say that your friendship was based on eating, drinking and motorcycling, which seems like a very good foundation for any friendship.
Well, it was. Yes. I mean, yeah, fundamentally, that was it. That was it.
Has much changed?
No. I mean, we're intrinsically part of each other's lives, you know, because obviously, you know, what's really interesting about what Dave and I have done is that if you can hear in the background some sort of rumbling going on.
It's not the end of the world.
It's not coming. It's just there's some construction work going on that's quite noisy. So forgive us for that. But Dave and I are intrinsically part of each other's lives because it's a bit like having a family business.
Yeah.
You know? And we're best mates. So that's really nice because an experience shared is an experience doubled.
Definitely.
You know? So it's brilliant.
And it was funny because you always kept like your home life quite separate for the time on the Cooksons. Mm. And obviously I was in a hotel in Newcastle. I remember you invited me for Sunday lunch to meet your family, hang out. And I was very grateful for me, proper Sunday roast cooked by himself. And it was very lovely. And he sold me a similar afternoon after being seduced by his roast dinner. He sold me a motorcycle. It was absolute rubbish.
It was. Listen, I'll have you know, it was really shiny.
Yeah.
Oh, well, if it's shiny, that's all that matters.
Yes, but transport needs to move.
But, Dave, you were born and bred in Barrow-in-Furness.
Yes.
And Si, you're from the northeast of England. So let's have a chat about the first desert island dish.
Mm.
So I want to know the dish that most reminds you of your childhood. Who wants to go first?
Oh, I think the dish that reminds me of childhood, again, it's my Sunday lunch, but it has to be roast chicken. And I always remember, I can smell it now. It would be done with Paxo stuffing.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be that. So the chicken would be stuffed with Paxo. We'd always have mashed potatoes, cauliflower cheese, and gravy. And it was a time when Jean Challis with the two-way family favourites, for those of you remember, you know, can remember it, you know, playing requests for the forces overseas, you know. And we like to play Puff the Magic Dragon. This is for Brian in BFPO 40 Dusseldorf.
And why? You always wanted to know why Brian wanted to hear Puff the Magic Dragon.
Yeah,
with Bernie's aunt.
I feel like this is a reference that's going over my head, you guys.
You're too young.
Oh, you're too young. Oh, it's just an animal on a podcast.
But
looking good, kid. Looking good.
But it was always, it was a program. She always did this. It was on Sunday mornings, but I can still smell the chicken coming through the anticipation. But those days, you know, roast chicken was three meals.
You know, of course.
It was once hot, once cold, and then something with the leftovers and soup with the bones. It was a major expense, but it was, and of course, chickens then were, you know, by nature, they were free range. They were expensive. It was a luxury. And it was a luxury that we had, and I appreciate. And still now when I go home, we call it in our house plumpy chicken.
Oh, plumpy chicken.
It sounds nice, doesn't it? Like a fat chicken.
And well, yeah, you don't want a skinny one.
No, and I'll say to my wife, what should we have? Should we do a plumpy chicken? And if you're feeling vulnerable, there's nothing better
there
than
is
that.
Nothing more
no.
comforting. Si?
Well, mine is, it's a beef flat rib broth.
Right.
Now, we only... what was remarkable about my mum was that, first of all, she was an amazing cook. And second of all, she had a knowledge of food that was second to none. And I always used to look forward to the autumn, and because this is when the flat rib was at its absolute best. So mum would only ever buy it in the autumn. And it's now what we would call, it's kind of like, what would we call it now? That bit of flat rib. It's a particular cut that you can get.
It's
and
it's flat rib. Rib.
Yeah. Flat rib. It's flat rib on the bone. It's beef rib on the bone. And mum used to cook it with barley and some lentils and carrots, onions, celery, some bay leaf, and it was an incredible and season it, and it was incredibly simple. But what was brilliant, that would go on the stovetop for a very, very, very long time, and the meat would just be falling off, and all of that collagen, all of that flavour and texture, because flat rib, by the very nature of it, has quite a long grain. So, I remember this grain; it was like spaghetti when I was little, because the grain of the meat just went on forever. You know,
and you've got the marrow from the bone as well.
Yeah, and it's so and the bone, and you always knew when it was white, when it was done, because the bone, all of the flavour would have been brought out into the rib. Into the broth, and it would be flecked white because it was starting to dry out now. So you knew you'd got all the goodness out of it. And then in the bottom oven, Mum would do stotty cakes, which is...
what are they?
Stotty cakes are kind of, depending on where you came from in the Northeast, there was stotty cakes and yeasty cakes.
Okay.
So yeasty cakes and stotty cakes are exactly the same things. But basically what they were quite round of varying sizes.
Yeah.
But they were incredibly yeasty and chewy and pulley, and
made of.
Well, it was a dough. It was a bread, and he used to dip that into a broth with loads of butter on it.
Yum!
And
my
goodness. It was just the most. It was, and the smell in the house was the main thing. And we do. I sometimes do it for Dave when he comes.
Well, we've got the flat rib broth recipe is in our meatball.
Yeah, that's right. It
but,
is.
It was funny. Yeah. Stella was an amazing cook. You know, sadly she passed away. But it's.
It sounds like you both had the most delicious childhoods. I want to know the first dish you learned to cook.
Well, the first dish I learned to cook, I mean, I can remember, like, my mum would bake on Mondays. It was always like a Victoria sponge, some bread and some scones. But I never really learned to cook. The first dish I ever cooked was because my mum, she had multiple sclerosis. She was disabled. And it was a dish I learned to cook through a cookbook. it was once my father was, he went to work. He was on like a 2 till 10 shift, but it was when my mum's MS was really starting. She'd gone to bed in the afternoon and couldn't get up. I knew my dad was home at 10 and I had to cook him something for his supper. And within the cooker that we had, it was a Radiation, was the brand of cooker, probably going back from the 50s. And there was a Radiation cookbook. And I looked through the book, I must have been like 7 years old, 8 years old, and I found a cheese and potato pie recipe.
Ooh.
Which was just stodge.
Get in.
I followed the recipe and I cooked it and I made it so that I knew that the family was in crisis and I knew my father would have to deal with it when he come home. But at least there was this immensely heavy cheese and potato pie in the oven. Later on, I told this story and we found... they found the cookbook. It was a production company found the cookbook, and indeed the cheese and potato pie recipe was there, just as I had imagined it. It's quite emotional, but I can remember clearly. That's
I remember
the first
seeing
thing.
That together.
In the Radiation cookbook. It's the first thing I ever learned to cook.
How old were you?
I must have been about 7 or 8 years old at the time. And it's with the old gas cooker, and it was basically a casserole dish that was lined with mashed potato, and then it was filled with more mashed potato. With
I
cheese
mean, that
in the
sounds
middle.
Like my kind of pie.
Yeah, I think kind of, yeah, it just sounds like
it was okay, mashed potato, butter and cheese and in various forms, and it was an old fashioned, but it was an attempt, and it's the first time I clearly remember, you know, attempt at cookery.
Yeah. Also, that's an amazing memory at such a young age that you connected food with comfort and, I don't know, trying to do something like that for your father
age. All I can say is we've both always used food as a way of caring and loving.
Yeah.
Either with each other, with our families. And, you know, going back to what you're saying about Stella.
Yeah.
She was an amazing cook. And I remember talking about the Cooksons. Halfway through that first series, the caterers were appalling. You know, in the old days, the catering used to be really good on television sets, but the afternoon teas these caterers were doing were appalling. You used to have afternoon tea, it was like ham sandwich, but cheap ham, white bread, processed cheese and ham, that was your choice. And the budget was a lot, and you were dealing with the budget.
So you went to
the production manager and said, look, this is, everybody hates the teas, my mother could do better.
So that's what we did. We got Mam in.
Oh, did she actually end up doing them?
Yeah, she did. Yeah. So we went, okay, Mam, that's the budget. That's the budget for the next 3 weeks that we're in studio. The crew's in revolt. I'm going to get lynched. So, and I want to fire the caterers. And me Mam went,
saw the chance to make a few quid. But I can remember Stella coming through the studio. This is a modern television studio with a wheelbarrow full of homemade pastries, scones, cakes. It was epic.
It was kind of epic.
It was epic. But the caterers hated him forevermore.
Yeah, they didn't
want to speak. It was a revolution that was never to be repeated. But I still remember her teas and the pastries. Everybody was like, wow.
And it was great, you know, because Mam would go, you know, because she'd get a bit like embarrassed every now and then. She'd say, I do hope you've had ample sufficiency. Oh. And I go, Mam, just ask them if they've had enough.
She
said, yes, I know, but you know, this is TV, our Simon. And I'd go, you know, so she'd go all posh on occasion. It was hilarious.
So I read that for 15 years, whilst working in the film industry, you hadn't had a pay rise. And it was kind of that brought about the decision to make a change.
Yeah.
And you say in your own words that you had lots of things that you could have done. I think you were thinking maybe you would start a lobster farm.
Yeah, there was surf and turf.
Surf and turf, yeah. The original idea, yeah.
But that you were very good at riding motorcycles. You had a good knowledge of food. And in your own words, you say you're very good at talking rubbish.
Yes, very true.
But how did it all happen? So you had the idea that you wanted to work together. What's the next step to actually getting your own TV show and making it happen?
Well, there is no next step, to be honest. what kind of happened was that Dave and I wrote a treatment together, and it took us 3 years to get the Hairy Bikers off the ground. So it wasn't an instant overnight success like most things.
Maybe it was the title, because the title of the program that we dreamt up was Motorcycles, Food and the Search for Nirvana.
Oh, right. Really catchy.
Not really.
Who came up with the Hairy Bikers?
Well, we both did, really. It was a
emails had just started.
Yeah.
So going back to 2000.
It was a subject heading, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No, everybody well, everybody and nobody lays claim to inventing the title. It wasn't us, mm-hmm. but somebody in the office, the production office, subject matter, hairy bikers. And it's simple as that, and that stuck. Like, oh, okay. And
that pretty much sums us up.
That'll do.
But so then after the 3 years, like, what were you just constantly trying to pitch to production people?
Well, because our careers had been behind the camera for you know, Dave 25, mine 15. And we knew a lot of people, and we had good reputations in the industry. So we decided to take our idea to strategic people that we knew, and also anybody that would listen to us, and kind of try and work it out from there, really. And we got our break. What we were looking for, because of our relationship, we, you know, it's quite humorous and we're quite new, enthusiastic. There was a match made in heaven, in the sense that we had a guy called John Stroud, who was a fantastic comedy director. And then we had a guy called Vikram Jayanti, who was a pretty heavyweight documentary director, which kind of fitted what Dave and I had wanted to kind of do, which is, you know, because food was fun. By our personalities and interaction, you were always going to get a laugh. But also, food was about social history. It was about culture. It was about all of those things. It was about travel. It was about some difficulties. It was about a lot of that, you know. So it was a really happy balance. And we found Vikram and John, and John and Vikram found us. And we moved off from there. And then Rowley Keating, who was then commissioner at the BBC, gave us our break, and off we went. Mm-hmm.
For a moment, I thought you said Ronan Keating, but you didn't.
It was Rowley.
It was definitely
Boyzone. His first commission as controller of BBC
That's so
Two.
Cool.
And he gave us one hour to see how we did.
Oh my goodness, high stress.
We just got on with it.
Now, over 20 cookbooks later, I mean, that's just incredible. It's your turn now. The third desert island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
I think it has to be a fruit de mer.
Ooh.
Because the fruits of the sea are both Dave and I actually are huge supporters of the fishing industry, and we're very proud of it, and we're very proud of the seafood that we bring from our waters and further afield. So I've eaten fruits of the sea around the world because it is without a shadow of a doubt my favorite thing to eat. And there's been numerous occasions that whether Dave and I have been in France or Italy or wherever, that I've sat and eaten this fruit of the mer, and Dave's got covered in crab juice and shell and stuff. You go, for God's sake, King. And I think that
it is southwest.
And having a fruit of the mer is just quintessential. You just get to know. Because where you normally have to buy it is at the docks, and you know, and you can eat it in posh restaurants if you want, but I tend not to do that. I'll either put it together myself, or I have eaten it in restaurants, but not necessarily really posh ones. And the great thing about fruits de mer is when you go and you actually look at where it comes from, you get the characters and personalities. So it's all intrinsically linked for me. I spend quite a lot of time, because my partner is in Sydney.
Oh, yes.
And the Sydney fish market is just mind-blowing. And
it's like nothing else.
It's like nothing else I've ever seen in the world. It is, first of all, it's flipping enormous. And second of all, there are species of fish that I hadn't come across before. So there was these great things called spanner crabs. And when spanner crab season is on, and it is the sweetest, most succulent crab meat I've ever eaten. So all of that that would be the best dish I've ever eaten around.
Do you remember the fruits de mer? We're filming Food Tour of Britain. We're in the northwest Scotland.
God. Perfect example.
And
yeah.
It was
unbelievable.
It was a French chef, and he'd moved his restaurant. I can't remember where it was. It was near Campbelltown.
It was near Campbelltown,
and,
yeah.
And he'd opened a restaurant there because he could get the seafood, and he did a fruits de mer. I just remember it. We both tucked into it that night. And it was surmounted with sea urchins on the top.
It was exquisite.
And it was just unbelievable, because the seafood from the cold waters up there, the langoustines, the oysters, but this I always remember, it's the first time I'd ever tasted sea urchin.
Oh, really?
And by goodness, it was good.
Yeah. But you're and so right, though, because we have amazing seafood and it feels a bit unsung, doesn't it?
Well, it does. Look, it's supply and demand, isn't it? You know, and the thing is that it's a shame that we don't demand more.
Definitely.
Because 75% of everything that we catch in the UK goes abroad. So.
Well, in the same programme, we went out fishing for langoustine with a great character, great fisherman. And he's got the boxes and they've got like little square holes for the grades of langoustine. And the langoustines he was catching were unbelievable, the triple A's. Well, they all went abroad.
Oh,
we managed
really?
To get some to cook our dish.
So interesting.
They all went abroad, but basically because people wouldn't pay for it here. And he was a Scotsman making a very good living.
He was.
With his langoustine, selling the most wonderful product.
And that's the great thing about Freedom Air is the characters and the personalities and the sea that are attached to that. Just getting those wonderful, wonderful, wonderful produce
definitely
onto a lot of ice.
It's yeah, so much more than just a dish, isn't it? Dave, it's your turn.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth desert island dish. What is your favourite sandwich?
Oh, my favourite sandwich. I love a Reuben sandwich.
Ooh, properly. Good option.
We did it a while ago on a programme where we made our own salt beef. And it wasn't that much difficult to do. We used brisket and we made the salt beef. And of course, you need that or corned beef, you know, for a Reuben sandwich.
Yeah.
So, but the homemade salt beef or pastrami.
It's fantastic.
It was good. You know, you have that on rye bread with sauerkraut and cheese like Gruyere. Oh. And it's...
So heaven. Good.
Yeah.
Are we regretting doing this before lunch?
Oh.
Who ever thought of putting a pickled cabbage in a sandwich with beef and cheese. But it has to be rye bread.
Making your own salt beef, is that the kind of thing that it is worth the effort?
Definitely.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, it is.
It is. Because there's a sense of achievement, isn't there?
There
it's
is.
Great.
It lasts for a while because obviously cold, it's great. Hot,
yeah.
Warm, it's great. I can reheat it. But it was good. But a Reuben sandwich. But I have been known just to do it with beef, cheese and sauerkraut. That's
I mean,
it.
Yeah, it's a good combo, however you look at it.
I mean, if you have to pick a sandwich at a service station the way up the M6, you can get one that's very passable.
Yeah, definitely. In total agreement with that. So back in 2012, you together lost an impressive 6 stone, which is amazing.
Yeah.
What was it that brought about such a drastic lifestyle change?
We're massively obese.
There was medical professionals that started to call us all morbidly obese.
Okay.
Hold on a minute. And then
were getting really fat.
And did that come as a shock or was it a case of just sort of slowly by slowly, nothing really changed, and then you were told that, and it was sort of.
I think for me, because I'm 10 years older than Si, I started to feel my age a bit, you know, I'd hit 18 and a half stone. I remember we were cooking a chocolate cake with gianduja, you know, like the Nutella.
Yeah.
In a street in Turin, it was about sort of 36 degrees. We were very heavy, very sweaty, cooking this chocolate cake, which is the most ridiculous calorie-laden confection. And that night at the hotel, I'm knocking on Si's door asking if I'd run out of my blood pressure tablets. I just think, no, this isn't really right.
It's not cool.
Yeah. It's not clever. And then we did Meals on Wheels, the series, which did very, very well for the BBC and did a lot of good. And not many people in their 80s were heavy. You know, they tend to be quite lean, leading fabulous lives. And then they said, is there anything we could do for the Olympics coming up? And we said, is there anything within like the Olympian science that could help blokes like us to get fit and lean like Olympians? And they came back with us just, well, yes, go on a diet.
Oh.
and we went to Newcastle University to be assessed.
Oh, I saw that.
Oh, that's one of those things where...
got put through the machine.
Yeah, but we didn't know what was going to happen. We turned up there, nobody had warned us. And it was one of those days where you look around, you think, what have we done? But actually, it's the best day of our lives. It's the best thing we could have done.
Yeah, it was a big turnaround.
It's a big turnaround. You know, it required a lot of thought and heavy thinking, really.
Yeah.
It's on telly, but the end of it is two blokes realising that I was 42% fat. You were...
46, I think.
Yeah, and that's like, you know...
It's ridiculous.
If that was
like
belly pork...
Like a prawn sandwich.
Oh, well, yeah.
If it was belly pork, I'd throw it back.
It would, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you had your first book, which was How to Love Food and Lose Weight in that series. Obviously hugely successful, and now this is the follow-up, and it's sort of about keeping the weight off, because that is now a number of years ago, and you guys still look great.
Well, it's trying to... The new book, The Hairy Bikers Make It Easy, it's The aim of that is to make it sustainable. That's what people, in each of the series, it's the sixth in the series, we try to address problems you have when eating healthily, also maybe losing weight, or when you've achieved the weight you want to be. You know, I think over the years we got quite good at it, really. And we're doing things like batch cooking on this. We're keeping the ingredients minimal, but we've never compromised on flavour or satisfaction.
Yeah.
I think that's the secret to it, because we are cooks and we love food. I say the chapter headings tell the story, really, the things you want to fix.
I think it is so clever, because I think we're all in agreement that food is the best thing ever, and it's so joyous. You don't want to take away from that. But with all of your recipes, it really doesn't feel like that. It's very clever.
It's interesting you should say that, because the ethos of all of the series of diet books hasn't changed at all.
Yeah.
As Dave said, it was our passion and we loved it. The most important thing for us was to produce great tasting food, but without the calories.
Yeah.
And that took a lot of research.
Well, it's much harder than just throwing in loads of butter and cream. Like, you really have to think about it.
You do. And the alchemy and balance of putting those recipes together and putting the ingredients together. So all we would say, if you're using the books, and we've had some fab reviews, it's been lovely. And you can fiddle about with them if you want. You know, there's no tried and tested way, but we can absolutely guarantee, if you follow the method properly, that you'll get a great tasting dish.
And also, we worked very closely with dietitians to make sure that the calorie counts and everything, we're not misleading people.
Yeah.
And you know, it's lovely. We want to write cookbooks that people are going to use, and not just sit there on a coffee table. You know, we're good pals with Delia Smith, and Delia was the same. You know, her books were there, you know, over the years were there to be used. And this one, I think, is a really useful book.
Definitely. I mean, your past reviews are anything to go by. I think you guys are going to be okay. Si, I think it's your turn. The fifth desert island dish, the dish you eat the most often.
Curry, I would say.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you have a sort of go-to curry?
I do, because I'm trying to watch the calories in curry, because it sometimes sneaks up on you. I'll always go with tandoori, because tandoori is one of those dishes that you can, you know, if you strip the chicken of its skin, God love it, and that's great, because the tandoori marinade that you put it in just gets really deeply into the meat, and it's really quite quick. And Dave and I have a wood fired oven at home.
Oh wow!
So it's
great. In the garden.
Yeah. Mm. So it's absolutely brilliant to stick the tandoori in the wood fired oven, because it's so intensely.
You guys are
hot.
Living the dream.
And it's fab. And fish and shellfish, tandooried prawns are just. And there's a great recipe for crab, but the spicing is slightly different, but it's really dry.
Yeah.
Flame.
Really good.
That's
in the new book.
No, it's not in the new book, but it's kind of Carolyn. It's an odd one, because you get lots and lots of coconut and spice, and you just cook it. It's just amazing.
It's not our recipe, but you can find it online.
Yeah, you'll definitely find it online. It's definitely not our recipe.
But we're saying about a diet, a chicken, when you take its clothes off, as it were, the whole chicken's about 700 to 800 calories.
Yeah.
So basically, you can quite happily sit there and eat half a chicken.
Yeah, it's the skin, isn't it?
But it's the flavour. But curry's always been pretty good for the diet too, because you can, you know, the spicy, there's no calories in spice.
Yeah.
No, and that's the key thing. That's key when you're dieting and you're trying to maintain that weight. Is those spices? You know, spicing is incredibly important, as is seasoning.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Right, Dave. I think it's your turn. The sixth desert island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish?
Well, lately, my dinner party dish of choice to serve people has been a porchetta, and that's like the Italian. It's an Italian roast. Basically, you've got the whole pork loin, but they leave the belly attached. So when it's opened up, it's quite long, it's quite flat, which gives you the opportunity to stuff it with herbs, you know, with thyme and garlic and some citrus. And so it's like a green seam in the middle. Then you roll it up and tie it. But the thing is, you're tying the belly around the loin. Sometimes the pork loin can be quite tough and dry.
Yeah.
But this is encased in the belly pork. Yeah. And of course, on the outside, you've got the crackling. Now, the last time I did this, I did that in the wood-fired oven too. So you've got the herbs go through the pork loin and through the belly pork. It's the most wonderful, thoughtful dish. You could have sliced that off. So you've got the crackling, the fatty belly pork, the lean loin, and then you've got the herbs. It's a very carefully thought out thing of porchetta.
Yeah.
The thing of beauty.
So if you didn't have a fired oven, could you
be normal oven?
And would you cook it low and slow? Or is it?
Oh, low and slow and finish off fast to get the crackling up.
Yeah.
But it's fine. A lot of butchers these days will make a porchetta for you if you ask for it. Or if you ask in advance, say you're making a porchetta, they will give you the pork loin with the belly attached. And it really is just a question of rolling it up yourself. It's really easy, but it's a real proper party piece. And serve that with, you know, just roasted potatoes with rosemary and garlic and maybe some spinach or you know, purple sprouting broccoli and greens. It's gorgeous.
And there's always a particular, there's a top secret to it, to a successful porchetta is the loin goes on the bottom.
Yeah.
So the belly pork is over the top, because what happens is that the belly pork then releases its juices and fat to keep the loin moist as you roast it over a protracted period of time. Because if you don't, you do it the other way, what happens is the loin goes dry, and you're left with something that resembles a bit you know, takes all the moisture out of your mouth. So it's a really great, it's a top tip. That
is a top tip.
Yeah, we do a really nice like fig chutney. So it's really
Brilliant with
Yeah, it's really quite nice when it's cold as well
in a
ciabatta.
Quince goes really well with that as well, with pork.
So it's round to mine for a porchetta then, Kingy.
Defo, dude.
I hope I'm invited. You
guys. Of course.
We're on to the seventh and final desert island dish. And it's the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. So perhaps you're going to go to the island together. So you might want to have the meal
Well, obviously we're on a desert island, so I think seafood's off this one.
Yeah, definitely.
Because we're going to be able to be self-catering. We both fish.
Bacon.
I think you could do the ultimate decadent dish, Kingy.
Right, what?
It's a Tony Dos Rossini. So you've got your croûte.
Yeah.
You've got a hunk of fillet steak.
Yeah.
You have a lobe of foie gras on top.
Ethical,
a masala sauce. And then a shaved truffle on the top.
Oh, my goodness.
It was
a dish
that Escoffier made for Rossini, the composer.
Yeah.
And I think for many years, the Tony Dos Rossini has been the footballer's dish of choice.
We're going to have a
blowout before we're in the seafood thing.
How very I'll fitting.
Go, I'll
yes.
And would you have a pudding?
Oh, now you've been controversial. Would we have a pudding? I'm really hopeless. No, I'd have a cheese board.
Okay, that's
actually.
Do you know what I'd have? We did it on. It was a thing program. So we did a banana creme brulee.
Oh yeah, no, that was good.
That was pretty evil. Because remember, I'm going to lose a bit of weight on this desert island.
Well, yeah, you might as well go all out.
Yeah, that's it. Full throttle. And then the cheese board as well.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh yeah, you've got to have, with crackers.
Okay. Yeah. Of course.
You know those little charcoal crackers. I love those.
Yeah.
And then the water biscuits.
Yeah. What's for starters?
Yeah,
yeah. Because the thing is that we don't do puddings normally. We do starters.
Okay, well, what would you have to start?
Again, we generally have seafood, but we can't. Cause a big plate of Italian salumi.
Yeah, could do that.
Yeah,
could do that. Yeah.
What are you going to wash it down with?
I think what you talked about last night.
Yeah, there's a
I've never had it because I can't afford it.
What is it?
It's called Magma, and it's by a guy that owns it called Frank Holmes Nielsen, and he's a Belgian guy that produces the most amazing natural wines in Sicily, and it's just the most incredible bottle of wine I've ever eaten.
And tell Margie how you came about to drink it.
Well, I was out with my partner, Michelle, and I, and I took her out because I wasn't going to be there for a birthday. So we went out for dinner and I didn't have my glasses on, you see, and nor did Michelle have her glasses on. So I missed a decimal point out.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm thinking, why is this all this big fuss about? I mean, it's a great bottle of wine and I knew about the guy that produced it. So I was going, oh man, Mish, that's a really good price for that wine. I mean, like, I can't believe it. And then I got the bill and it really wasn't.
It wasn't a good price.
And I said, and we vowed that never, ever are we ever going to go out together again without having our glasses. It was really
She could have been playing a trick, pretending.
No, she really wouldn't, because she would have hit the flaming roof if
You're allowed to take with you one luxury item. What are you going to take with you?
I'm going to take a motorbike.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, because I can get around the island. Yeah. Something to tinker with, because it's always been a passion as well.
Yeah, true.
Nothing too heavy.
We could give you a broken motorbike that you can fix.
No, I want to get around the island.
Look at our faces.
For fun.
It'll be an off-roader, so it could go up and down and around
the
island.
There's no tarmac, dude. It's got to be an off-road.
Well, yeah, on off, you know, but the beach as well.
Yeah.
You know, something quite lightweight as well. Nothing too heavy that's going to get bogged down in the sand.
Si, what are you going to take?
Sharp knives.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, there's no, I have a pathological hatred for blunt knives.
Yeah, they're the worst.
Because there's absolutely no point in having a blunt knife, as there's no point in having a blunt axe or anything with a blade that's blunt is useless.
That's true. I can see that's something you really get beyond your bonnet about.
I do.
I will give you a knife sharpener as well.
I do.
Yeah. Can I have petrol then? We've got the motorbike.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thinking for plumber.
This is good. It's good. And can we take string?
Oh, guys, that's just getting greedy. You've got the motorbike, you've got knives, but yeah, you can take some string. Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you so much for letting us hear your desert island.
Thanks, Margie.
Thanks, Margie.
How great are the hairy bikers? I definitely had a little fangirl moment trying to invite myself to supper. Pretty sure I wanted to nominate myself to be the third hairy biker, but I don't quite have the beard for it. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to come and find me on Instagram at Made by Margie. I share lots of recipes, more desert island dishes inspired food. And you can head to www.desertislanddishes.co for loads more recipes and a whole list of the different guests that we've had so far. Thanks for listening. Bye.